last Sabbath. Some of you were here last Saturday Sabbath on that 103 degree day. Do you remember it? Oh, what a day. Some of you went over across the street and had lasagna, of all things, right? Last Sabbath, we talked about a story from the scriptures. We don't talk about it very often. Here are the characters from the story. The king that you heard Kiana read so well, King Ahasuerus, he's in charge of the kingdom from India to Ethiopia. His first in command, his CEO, his CFO, his everything, his prime minister, that's Haman. He's in charge. Then there's Queen Vashti. She only makes it for one chapter in the story. Last week, she had to leave. She got banished because she wouldn't dance in front of the king's men. Then there's the new queen, Esther, who replaces Vashti. Well, Esther and her cousin Mordecai, they're both Jews. They've probably come from Jerusalem, from their families had to leave when the war came. Esther's parents didn't survive, so her cousin Mordecai adopted her. And together, they round out the character of stories from last week. Last week, we learned that these particular characters, King Ahasuerus, by the way, he spends more time drunk in the Bible than anything. I'm just telling you what's in there. Mordecai spends more time angry than anything. What's he angry about? He's angry. Haman. Haman, the prime minister, he's angry because Mordecai in particular, the Jew Mordecai, the Bible calls, he won't bow down to Haman and show him respect. This is Mordecai's silent protest. He's not going to bow to Haman. Over that anger, Haman goes to the king and says, I have an idea. We are going to take care of all the Jews. Esther chapter 3 records it this way. We will wipe out, kill, and destroy all the Jews, both young and old, even women and little children. It'll be organized in one day of bloodshed from Ethiopia to India, 127 provinces. Look at the sweep on the map. One day of bloodshed the king has allowed. Now Esther, she's living on the inside. Mordecai puts some pressure on her. Esther, come on, you better do something. You have access to the king. So Esther goes to the king. This is the first time the king has heard that his wife is actually a Jew, and he's angry. Not because she's a Jew, he's angry because his prime minister is going to kill all of Esther's people. The king is so angry, he says, you know, I'm just going to take care of Haman, my prime minister. He kills him, puts him up on a pole, a sharp pole, way above high for the whole capital city to see. It's a real city in Iran today, this capital city in the Bible. All the people can pass by and see what happens to those who cross the king. And then the Bible summarizes, it's almost kind of boring, and the Bible summarizes Esther chapter 7, verse 10, and the king's anger went away, because he impaled Haman. This is where the traditional story of Esther usually ends, about a third grade reading level, this editorial. It usually ends right here in all Christian churches, and we're to know that the king is in charge, but he's given his power to these other people. Don't cross them or you'll end up like Haman on the post. And Esther had a lot of power, more than she knew. Her cousin Mordecai shows us what faithful living looks like if you don't bow down to the powers that be. Yes, we said last week, in this writing, we don't hear anything about faith or prayer or this habit like what we have, rituals of going to worship and giving offerings. We don't hear about the God of the heavens above or the earth below. None of that makes it into the story in Esther, which makes many people ask the question, why is this even in our Bible? Last week, I asked, what is this story good for? I got an email right after church, the noon service. The email said this, "Dear Pastor, good sermon, but be careful. You will make people uncomfortable messing with Esther. She's a precious story." Signed, Kirby Oberg. True. What is this story of Esther doing in our Bible? What's it good for? Who feels good at the end of the day? Who can lie down and sleep in peace? Who feels great about their relationships they've cultivated? Who's without anxiety or fear in this story? What's it doing here? Would we be better off without it? Is it like, I remember the first time our daughters at home saw their first full-length feature Disney animated movie at home, showing on the large screen in the house, right? I come around the corner, they're watching Ariel the Little Mermaid, you know, the bright red, kind of just a little bit rebellious, spunky, independent kind. Guys, date someone like that. Right, you know, Ariel, she wants legs so she can live on land and marry the prince. I come around the corner, both of the girls are hiding behind the couch with their hands over their eyes like this. But just enough room so you can see through, right? And you can watch. And Ursula, that big octopus, is on the screen. So I say to the girls, I think we should turn this off. This is too scary for you. Girls, we get out from behind the couch. We'll turn her off. No, Mama, we're not scared. No, we're fine. No, let's turn it off. When you watch like this, I can tell. No, we don't want to miss it. It's just that we don't want to see it. Is that Esther? We don't want to miss it, but we don't want to see it. So we don't tell the whole story. We don't go all the way to the end of the story, chapter 8 and 9, because the story's not over. Here's the trouble. There's a death decree, and the Jews still have to die because it's the law. Haman might be hanging up there on the post, but the Jews are still going to die. So King Ahasuerus says to his queen Esther, I'll give you all my power. Go ahead, you and Mordecai, think creatively. What can you come up with? However we could solve this, I'll give you my pen. I give you my ring. I bless whatever plan you create. Esther chapter 8 records their plan, beginning with verse 10. They wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, and they sealed the order with the king's royal ring. He sent letters with riders mounted on royal horses bred from mares known to run fast so they can get the word out quickly. The order allowed Jews in each town to join together and to defend their lives. The Jews, they're free to wipe out, to kill, destroy. We're going to come back to that. They are free to wipe out, to kill, and destroy. Every army of people in any province that attacked them, along with women and children. They can also take and keep anything the attackers had owned. The one day in all the provinces, King Ahasuerus, on this one day, they could do all of this was the 13th day of the 12th month, all across the 127 provinces. So a copy of the writing was to become law in each province and made public and put on display for all the people to read. The Jews were supposed to be ready to get back at their enemies. Chapter 9 records the battle. Chapter 9, verse 6 says, the Jews put down all their enemies with sword blows, with killing, with destruction. They did whatever they wanted with those who hated them. In the fortified part of the capital city, Susa, the Jews killed 500 people. They also killed the 10 sons of Haman. Now the king comes to Esther and says, my queen, are you pleased with this? Does this make you happy? She responds, actually, we'd like one more day for battle. Could we have that? We'd like to kill people for one more day. Whatever you want. So they give them one more day, and the Bible says the Jews go on to kill 200 more people in the capital city and 75,000 men, women, and children across all the provinces. Oh, and by the way, King, that's kind of not all. Those 10 dead sons of Haman's, we killed them all. They're all out on the battlefield, but is it okay if we retrieve their bodies? Because we kind of want to put them up on the poles, too. That'd be cool. Can we do that? So they go and retrieve the bodies of Haman's 10 sons, and they put them right up there where Haman's bodies were pitched for the whole capital city to see. And someone who knows something about their history would remind us this morning, Mordecai and Esther's history, they're descendants of King Saul. They know about great battle, epic stories like this. Joshua trying to cross the river of Jericho. They know war scenes, and they remember King Saul had 10 sons who were also killed in battle. two different battles, but 10 dead boys, and the enemies took King Saul's boys and put them up on pales, up high. Payback is a... Are you happy now, Queen Esther? The king asks Queen Esther the Jew. When it's all done, they throw a party. The Bible says, now they're done with their enemies. They've put them all down. They gather their children. They eat good food. They tell stories. They give gifts. And from now on, they will tell their children and their grandchildren about this day when they put down their enemies. They'll celebrate a festival every year that will be called Purim. Perhaps it's as Frederick Buechner says, Frederick Buechner, pastor, poet, says, there seems to be every reason to believe God considers himself well out of this story. We have everything in this story. What shall we do with this group of broken people? We have gender issues, class issues, race issues, faith issues, politics, bigotry, racism, genocide, retribution. All with the refugee life with Mordecai and Esther trying to hang on to any little scrap of identity from home. What shall we do with the story of fractured humans? I'm calling this bad guilt, good guilt. Last week I used those terms, bad guilt, good guilt, for every character in the story. Nobody is free of this. Doesn't matter what role you played in this story. Bad guilt, good guilt, for the king, for the queen, for the Mordecai, for Esther, for all of them. Now, and while most of us here will never participate in something this graphic, this horrible, all of us here today know about anxiety and pain and fear and something we call guilt. We all know about this trauma. I want to borrow the language from Brené Brown, University of Texas, Houston. She tells us when we're talking about guilt, some of these are my lines, some of them are her lines, that there is something called bad guilt, I suggest. She would call it shame. Shame is this thing we feel about ourselves on the inside that says, I am bad, actually. I am the problem. The problem is me. Problem's not out there. Shame is all wrapped up in here, and our whole body responds to it. Think of how you cower when you get your first pimple on your face. You got that picture in your mind? How you can hardly get your face up and out to see the world? That's shame because I feel so terrible about me. Shame says that something is wrong, I can feel it, I'm pretty sure I can't fix it. Specialists tell us we can begin to feel shame maybe as early as 2 or 3 years of age, at least by age 4 or 5. Isn't that something? Look at the children in your lives, grandchildren in your lives. Playmates in your homes. I can remember the first time my memory of shame comes to mind now as an adult. It's when I carried this doll with me. This is my first and favorite doll. Isn't she fabulous? She's got little, this is a sock that's made into a diaper to cover her privates because her clothes are all gone. She's sewn up in just about every joint. She's got little safety pins every other place. Her hair's all gone. I used to carry her like this. I know, and lots of you are saying she's a little creepy, like she came from a horror film. She used to wind up. She had a little thing here you would turn and her head would move and music would come out. Oh, you think that's creepy? I remember carrying this doll around, and at some point I'm looking at all the other little girls and I realize they carry beautiful little baby dolls in their arms. And I'm looking down at my little diapered, wounded thing going, who carries a doll that looks like this? I need a good-looking doll. This is so embarrassing. What's wrong with me that I settle for a doll like that? Ugh. Shame. What's wrong with me? Shame is when my parents said you have to wear boots, galoshes, to the junior high Bible study on Friday night. Oh my word, who's gonna look at you with galoshes on? They come up here, they were not fashionable at that time. That's shame. I'm not going dressed like that. Shame is when my parents put us in a 1974 brown Chevy station wagon to go to college. We drove down College Avenue in a brown Chevy that looked brown like dirt. And I imagined myself driving down College Avenue in a BMW. I'm in a brown Chevy. You just want to crawl under something and hide. What's wrong with me? Shame is when you ask a girl to the banquet and she says, I'll go with you if nobody else will go. What's wrong with me? Banquet, old-fashioned word for party. That's shame. What's wrong with me? Brené Brown says, it doesn't belong in our lives, friends. Let me say that again. It doesn't belong in our lives. She says if you take shame and you put it in a petri dish like this, some of you take biology and microbiology. They gave us one of these when I was a freshman in college, micro class. They made us take it outside, put it under a tree and see what we could grow. Do we ever do that here, Dr. Sutter? We do. Do we grow funky stuff? We do, right? Because the air is disgusting here. Brené Brown says, if you put shame in a petri dish and you close it up, it takes three things to flourish. It takes secrecy, silence, and judgmentalism. And if you leave it alone, shame will thrive. But in our story with God, in your story with God, in our story with each other, the words shame on you never apply. If someone is saying shame on you in your life, it doesn't belong in your life. Can I say that to you? If you're in a relationship and someone's making you feel terrible about yourself, that shame does not belong in your life, friends. We call that bad guilt. Now there's something I call good guilt. Good guilt is the part of the conscience that I think the Holy Spirit can work with. Good guilt doesn't say that I'm bad. Good guilt says I've done something wrong. Good guilt is that kind of thing that brings discernment. I've hurt someone. I've not lived up to my part of the relationship. It's all relational, by the way. My kitchen doesn't make me feel guilty. The dishes need to be done, but they can't make me feel guilty, right? I feel guilty when we invite college students and there's not enough food to feed you all. Oh, that makes me feel guilty because we want to feed students. Guilt is always relational. Maybe I didn't make the right decision or you exercised the correct judgment or I've done something wrong. Good guilt can function as part of our conscience to remind us there's the choice I made, but here's the ideal, what I'd like to do and be in the world. Good guilt can help us reconcile the differences between those two. And the point of guilt is not that we dwell there. It's not that we wander into it and we stay for the rest of our lives. Your parents, those of you who are young, your parents feel guilty for all sorts of things they did to you when you were being raised. God bless you, you survived. But feeling guilty about some of those decisions, we're not meant to dwell there. We don't wear guilt like an extra layer of clothes. We ask the Spirit for the insight. We repair what we can. We forgive what we must. And we move on, friends. That's how guilt functions in a healthy way. We move on. So if someone asks you, do you feel guilty about what you did? And you say, yes. And they say, good. That's not the role of guilt. We have 3,100 students between La Sierra Academy and La Sierra University, and I want to tell you today, shame and bad guilt have no place in your stories on our campus. We believe that. So, sometimes we confuse these things in the church community, in Christianity, in faith tradition. We take shame and we take guilt. I'm probably bad. I probably made wrong decisions, and we sometimes layer them over top of each other. And because we want to get Christians to conform and do the right thing, and because we worry about pleasing God, Sometimes all of this gets wrapped up inside of us. Some of you were here the night the freshmen came to campus, that first Friday night. We talked about the story of the Hunchback of Notre Dame. Classic example of shame and guilt getting wrapped together in the faith story. Listen to this between Quasimodo and Frollo. Frollo, who is the archdeacon of the cathedral.
Shall we review your alphabet today?
Oh, yes, Master. I would like that very much.
Very well. A?
Abomination.
B?
Blasphemy.
C?
Contrition.
D?
Damnation.
E?
Eternal damnation.
Good.
F? Festival.
Excuse me.
Forgiveness.
You said festival.
No!
You are thinking about going to the festival.
It's just that you go every year.
I am a public official. I must go. But I don't enjoy a moment. Thieves and cut purses, the dregs of humankind, all mixed together in a shallow, drunken stupor.
I didn't mean to upset you, Master.
Quasimodo, can't you understand? When your heartless mother abandoned you as a child, anyone else would have drowned you. And this is my thanks for taking you in and raising you as my son?
I'm sorry, sir.
Oh, my dear Quasimodo, you don't know what it's like out there. I do. I do. Remember what I've taught you, Quasimodo. You are deformed.
I am deformed.
And you are ugly.
And I am ugly.
And these are crimes for which the world shows little pity. You do not comprehend.
You are my one defender.
Out there they'll revile you as a monster.
I am a monster.
Out there they will hate and scorn and jeer.
Only a monster.
Why invite their calumny and consternation? Stay in here. Be faithful to me. Grateful to me.
I'm grateful.
Do as I say. Obey and stay in here.
You are good to me, Master. I'm sorry.
You are forgiven. But remember, Quasimodo, this is your sanctuary.
My sanctuary.
I can hardly watch it. You see the layering? So that Quasimodo could say thank you to a person who calls him ugly and deformed? You're so good to me, Master. Stay in here. This must also be what God wants for Quasimodo. And we forget the campus that's got the sculpture of the prodigal son at the front of the sanctuary. We forget that God's grace just never ends, that guilt is what grace takes away from us. And when we make mistakes again and again and again, that doesn't wipe away the guilt God's given or the grace God's given us. More bad decisions on my part never removes God's grace. God's grace is that thing that tells us we are not guilty. And then we struggle with, well, if we're not guilty, but probably God doesn't like me, at least. In Christian tradition, sometimes we layer these together. But hear the words from the psalmist this morning that were read earlier. Psalm 26 said, because of your faithful love, God, you are right in front of me. I can walk upright in your truth. Purify my mind and my heart. Yes, all of that. Put me to the test, because with God we are safe. So, what shall we do in light of this with Esther and Mordecai and this story in the Bible that troubles us? Interesting genre compared to all the others in the Old Testament. Not time this morning to talk more about that. I just want to call attention to what happened to Mordecai and Esther that moment when they can do whatever they want and they decide that they will wipe out, kill, and destroy all the people. How many of those things must you do to defend yourself? Look there. Wipe out, kill, and destroy. Must you do all three to simply defend your people? But at some point, Esther and Mordecai, they step over the line and they move from self-defense to retaliation and retribution. And something in their mind, their conscience, the good guilt must be saying, this isn't so good. Someone smashed out a window on our car in the driveway this morning, right? There's little pieces of glass everywhere, all over the whole thing, a mess. When I came out early this morning, I look at the broken window and I think, I'd like to know who did this because I'd like to tell them, don't do this to people. But I don't look at the window and say, I'd like to know who did this so I can go smash their window too. I'd like to get a bat and I'll just take care of the whole car, and while I'm at it, I'll get a knife and take care of the tires. In fact, I'd like to beat them a little. Somewhere Esther and Mordecai stepped over the line from self-defense to retribution and retaliation. This is what our conscience is for. What shall we do with this story in our Bible? I'd like to go easy on Esther and Mordecai, primarily because God goes easy on me. God goes easy on us. I'd like to have the most generous interpretation as possible with the story. I'd like to understand. I'd like to exercise empathy. Empathy is that thing we do that solves shame and guilt. Empathy is that thing where we sit down with each other, we pull up a chair, and we say, tell me how it is. I'd like to hear your version of the story. Can you say it again? Oh, I can relate. Yeah, that happens to me too. Yeah, my car window got smashed once too. I did sort of feel like hitting somebody. Empathy is that thing. I'd like to pull up a chair and sit with Esther and Mordecai and empathize with their story. And when I do that, here's where I land with this terrible tale in Scripture. I think it's a survival story. I think for Esther and Mordecai, remember their people, the Israelites, descendants of King Saul. Their tribe is the tribe that heard Moses yell, "Let my people go." That's their storyline. That's what they tell around their holiday tables. So they're a little tribe of people still trying to survive. And here's the latest chapter in their epic. It's a survival story. Esther and Mordecai. In survival stories, we all do this. We all love a good survival story, actually. We all would like to know we can make it through what we're enduring right now, that someone else has gone before it, and if they could do it, we can do it. Survival stories move us from survival to thriving, actually. It's why women tell their birthing stories to each other. It's why they sit around and talk about childbirth and labor, because they want to know they can get through it because their friends got through it. It's why guys don't talk about birthing stories. Survival stories, we love them. This is why we turn on YouTube and GodTube and we hear Chariots of Fire in the background and we watch inspirational video after inspirational video. Because we love survival stories, they inspire us. 2-3 weeks ago, our Pastor Vaughn went to Lake Tahoe, the Ironman. We look at the pictures of Pastor Vaughn because we need these survival, these are conquering stories. Pastor Vaughn, I'm calling him Iron Vaughn now. Iron Vaughn, who swam, cycled, and ran, and came in number 22 out of about 1,400 people in the competition. Anybody going on the 5K tomorrow morning? Come out to the field, 10 a.m. It's a little fundraiser for our academies. $25 gets you in, supports La Sierra Academy. But carry pictures of Iron Vaughn in your head when you're walking tomorrow, right? It's why we go to the computer and we love to watch deaf people who can dance in sync with the rhythm. And we watch small little deformed people who will stand in front of a crowd of thousands and deliver a speech. It's why we watch men in wheelchairs compete as athletes. And all of these inspirational videos, it's what we show ourselves because we all need to know we can survive. I'm seeing a survival story in Esther and Mordecai. We want to survive. We want to thrive. We want more of that. I see that in Esther and Mordecai. And I see God who brings something out of their story. Yeah, even out of this, God can bring good. What's not in Esther as we close this morning? One teaching of this story summarizes the Esther and Mordecai story this way. And it actually is focused to us Adventist Christians. One teaching of the story, summary of the story says, you know, there will come a time at the end when everyone will be persecuted for their faith. Everyone will have a choice like Mordecai, whether to bow down and pay homage or not. You better watch out, sort of all of you Christians, because your day of reckoning is coming. Will you stand for your faith or not? I don't find this to be what the story is about. And in light of the events that have taken place this week in the Southern Oregon on the campus of Umpqua Community College in particular, I want to say this morning, in light of those events, that we need to be very careful that we do not confuse the call to stand for Christ in these difficult days, that we don't confuse that with unstable, fringe, isolated, sick minds. Friends, we can't confuse these stories. That we have to be careful when unstable people are armed like sophisticated soldiers in our world, that we not confuse martyrdom with mental illness. This is not what's in the story with Mordecai and Esther. In fact, on that college campus in Southern Oregon today, and in that community where people bleed, we want to do what God calls all of us to do, to empathize, to hear, to pull up a chair, hear everyone's place in this broken tale, for we're all at the end of the day holding our broken humanity in our hands and asking for God's grace. It's one of you, the last time one of the school shootings happened, one of you came to me and said, there's something we're supposed to be doing. I don't know what we're supposed to do, but this is La Sierra. We stand with people. And so we did, 3 years ago, to Sandy Hook Elementary School, when that massacre happened. We signed cards and sent messages. Today, we'll do the same. Scattered along the platform will be cards where you can send wishes and prayers to the people in a college campus. It could be any one of our campus communities. In fact, active shooter drills have taken place on both of our campuses in the last few weeks. So it is, we empathize with these people rather than exercise judgment over them. One of the cards here will be for the 26-year-old Chris Harper Mercer, his family, the man armed with the guns on Thursday who did the destruction. Please look if you'd like to sign the card for his family. It'll be here closest to this speaker. This is empathy. Where do we get empathy like this? Pastor, I'm so caught up in my anger and rage over these things. How do you get to empathy from here? Well, friends, just look to our Jesus. It's Jesus who said to the short little guy, Zacchaeus, who had no friends, hey, come here. We're going to go to your house and eat today. Not just out here in the market. Take me home. It's Jesus who said to the woman at the well, I know you've got five husbands. I get it. Yeah, I can take the water right out of your hands. I'll stand with you in the light of the day and let everybody watch. It's our Jesus who felt the young adult who'd been bleeding for 12 years touch the hem of his garment and pull the power right out of him. And he looked to her and said, that kind of courage? Go for it, sister. It's Jesus who went to the man with the mental illness. He had so many demons in his head, he couldn't hear himself think. And Jesus said the most basic and human thing imaginable. Friend, what's your name? It's Jesus who looks at his own friend Judas the night before Judas turns him over. And he says to Judas eye to eye, go ahead and do quickly what you're going to do. And finally, it's our Jesus on the cross who looks down to see his weeping mother, the woman who birthed him and fed him and changed him and groomed him. And he looks to his own mother from his place of pain on the cross and says, Mom, you're not going to go through this alone. You're going to go with John. John, hang on to her and take her home because this is going to get rough. If you find yourself short on empathy today, look to our Jesus, the source of all healing. What's this story doing in the Bible? I don't know. Pretty much like me and you today. Broken humanity, in need of our Jesus, friends. Dwell on these things while we sing.